Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 2006. Today's session is entitled A Living Wage. Presenter is John Marty. Let's listen in.
I want to, you know, talk mainly about that, but interested in the discussion about the whole concept of how we view compensation and wages for people. But the subtitle or the paragraph that went under the title was, why do working people live in cars and homeless shelters? Why can't they afford to send their kids to the doctor? And so we're going to discuss the politics of minimum wages and look at the need for jobs that pay a livable wage. And to start, I'd like to say that we all have different conceptions of what's necessary for life, what a livable wage would be. I thought it was interesting about a year and a half or 2 years ago, one of the Minnesota Timberwolves, the NBA team, Latrell Sprewell, was in contract negotiations, and he was complaining about his inadequate contract offer and saying, why should he work hard for them if they're not going to treat him decently? After all, quote, I've got my family to feed. Latrell Sprewell was making $14.6 million a year at the time.
That's a big family. Things were tough all over.
He had a lot of sympathy from people. He's no longer with the Timberwolves. And while I don't have particularly a lot of sympathy for that and so on, there certainly are a big concern about the large number of working people who can't make ends meet anymore. And I mean, I think you all, I don't have to recite all the statistics, but I think it's about one in every six Americans now can no longer afford health care. And most middle class families are one illness away from bankruptcy. I think they say that that over half of the bankruptcies, the personal bankruptcies in our country now, are healthcare related. And of those half, more than three quarters of those were people who were insured. They're working people who had insurance at the time of illness or some serious medical condition, either stopping their ability to work or they lose their health insurance because of it, and then they go into bankruptcy. The economy is very fragile, even for a lot of people who feel securely middle class now. But we have, in Minnesota, I think they say that roughly half the people in our homeless shelters are working people or children of families of working parents. And that's something new, that's not 30, 40 years ago. Food shelf use is up in Minnesota, I think in most states these days. Despite the booming economy most years, it's leaving a lot of people behind. And we had, I like to call it a social compact, our government made with American people roughly seven or eight decades ago during the Great Depression. It was a compact that expected certain things from workers. It was the 40-hour work week. You're expected to work 40 hours, and in exchange for that, we put in protections for worker safety. We put in minimum wage, and it wasn't meant to be a wage that's going to make you well off, but it was supposed to provide a floor for everyone. It's supposed to be enough to meet the necessities of life. And the 40-hour week was, you're not expected to have to work 70 hours a week to do that. The old 6-day-a-week, 10-hour workday, and the 6-day, 12-hour workday past times were not expected to be there. Children were not expected to work, were not allowed to work. And you'd have a secure retirement, and Social Security was meant to provide that. This was the compact. You do this work, you work 40 hours a week, that's your contribution to society. In exchange for that, we're going to make sure you have some Social Security, not just in your retirement, but it was the minimum wage to take care of that. Same time, businesses were allowed to, expected to operate under a free market system, but that they had certain requirements, including those of paying minimum wage, including those mandatory overtime if you work more than 40 hours a week, etc. And we had the expectation that government and others would step in to fill any gaps there were. This is not a social compact we can say we've ever lived up to. We've never done a good job of it. We've done better some years than others. Recent years we've been going the wrong direction. Again, as I mentioned earlier, about half the homeless people in Minnesota on any given night are families of working people or working people themselves. And 20, 30 years ago, I remember the only homeless shelters we had in Minnesota that I was aware of were Salvation Army types of programs for street people, people who were chronically mentally ill or chemically dependent, people with serious troubles who we've never done very well with. But you didn't have families, you didn't have working people, you didn't have kids in homeless shelters at that time. So we've been going backwards. But is this social compact an outdated idea? I don't think so. I have a poll from April 2000 that suggests there's universal agreement, or as close to universal as we get in our American political process. 94% of Americans agree with the statement. As a country, quote, as a country, we should make sure people who work full-time are able to earn enough to keep their families out of poverty. And that 94% agree with that statement. That suggests that the social compact of the 1930s is still something that's got very, very broad support.
Could you repeat? Could you say that one more time?
It's 94%.
No, what the question was that in the poll.
The question, 94% agreed with this statement. As a country, we should make sure that people who work full-time are able to earn enough to keep their families out of poverty. And what people think they should be, that same poll, what do you think it should be, what's being out of poverty? Something like 69% said that they thought for a family of four, you needed at least $35,000 a year, which is about double what the official poverty line is. So Americans have a broad support for the concept that you work, you put in a day's work, you should get enough pay to take care of yourself. And if we're a caring, humane society, and we decide it's not acceptable to leave people hungry, homeless, without medical care, then we have two ways of dealing with it. The first of which is the one we're going to talk about mainly here, the idea of making sure that workers earn enough money to take care of themselves. The second alternative or addition to that is that you subsidize basic necessities, healthcare, housing, food, and whether you do that through government welfare programs or you do it through nonprofit social services or church charitable giving or however you do it, if the compact is you work, you're taken care of, or you're going to have enough money to be taken care of, you either have to have them earn that much or you have to somehow give it to them. Take a look at the second option, the one of subsidizing. That has been the policy and the practice since the New Deal, though not very well done, at times anyway. And it's necessary if workers aren't paid enough, and it would always be necessary for people who have no chance of working or because of whether it's some mental or physical disability or age, either because they're very elderly or because they're children, people we don't expect or want to be working. In those cases, you would need some way to support them. So a child who loses their parents, you'd need some way to support it. That's what I think the concept of a welfare system was to be. But the fact that we may need this option for some people doesn't mean it's a good option for the masses. I don't think it would ever get there because there's, I don't know if it's growing opposition, there's always been strong opposition to use the word welfare. In politics, that's a good word not to use if you're talking about something you support. And that's for obvious reasons. People don't like that concept. And we've had deep cuts in funding many times year after year. Last year's federal budget cuts dumped many people from food stamps, school lunch program. We keep going backwards on that. So even in generous times, churches and governments and nonprofits didn't meet the need, we're not likely to meet the need in the near future. And the other thing is it's not an ideal way to take care of meeting people's needs. Among other things, it certainly can lead to dependence. Another thing that it does is causes great trouble in allocating how you get the right amount of money to the right people. it's a big mess and people can take advantage of it while others are not helped out. It's not a good way to run an economy. So then we turn to the second option. If you either have to subsidize somebody to make ends meet or you have to make sure they get enough money on their own, then you talk about decent wages. And one of the solutions often say, well, the solution to that is we got to educate people more so they can get better paying jobs. Well, on a microeconomic level, you or I, if we're in that shape where we are working in the hotel, changing sheets, hotel cleaner, if I go back to school, get a better education, and I can find a better paying job, that takes care of me from a microeconomic point of view. But as a society at large, even if we give everybody four-year college degrees and grad school, you're still going to need people who change the sheets. You're still going to need people who work at the fast food joints. You're still going to need people who are doing that. And what you'll have is basically a lot of overeducated, overqualified people, overqualified people for the level of jobs in the economist's way of looking at it. So on a microeconomic point of view, you can say the solution is education. But it's not the solution on the system-wide thing to take care of people who fall through the cracks, the workers who can't make ends meet now. And these workers are all around us. Some of you may be in that shape. I remember a woman who came to our committee a couple years ago and talking about how she lived. She was working, she said that previous summer she had worked at a small restaurant as a waitress, small restaurant an hour north of the Twin Cities, and she was living in her car. Her boss didn't know that, her coworkers didn't know that. They just knew that every day after work she liked to swim in the lake that was right behind the restaurant. Mm-hmm. That was her shower. And people are generally ashamed to talk about this. They don't want others to know about it. She didn't want her employer or her colleagues to know she was homeless. But very much was. It's a very common thing from people we wouldn't expect to see it in. So if we start talking about fair wage, livable wage, we got to say that the minimum wage isn't there. It's grossly inadequate to meet needs. You could double the minimum wage and it's not really going to meet most families' health and housing and food needs and so on. It's the situation where an employer that pays low wages, sub-living wage doesn't mean the employee dies. It means that in order to get those necessities of life, they turn to public assistance or somewhere else to get funding. Currently, where's government's role in this? Currently, government does not do a good job. It certainly doesn't require a living wage. It doesn't even do a good job of encouraging it. Governments of every level give generous subsidies to some businesses that pay sub-living wages. A number of communities have begun to address it through so-called living wage laws, but there are many governments giving subsidies, large multi-million dollar subsidies to multi-hundreds of millions of dollar subsidies in some cases to employers who don't pay more than $6, $7, $8 an hour. And I know in Minnesota we have tax increment financing, which is basically a tax subsidy to employers. Walmart and Target and all the retail chains seem to be the best ones at getting those, despite the fact that they're not paying a living wage. Government also, in its own programs, often doesn't provide enough. Several years ago in California, there was a proposal to make sure all state employees would get at least $10 an hour. And in most governments, most state employees would get more than $10 an hour. Who knows what the category is? I know in Minnesota, state employees are generally paid a living wage, though then you look at how much we compensate nursing homes, because under Minnesota's system, nursing homes get virtually all their money at a preset amount per patient, whether they're private pay patients or medical assistance patients. And they don't get enough money to pay their workers much. They're a typical nursing home aide, many of whom have worked there 20 years or more, and they do it because they care about senior citizens who they see not getting the care they need. And they're paid, the average in Minnesota is just about $11 an hour. And many of those healthcare workers, and they are healthcare workers, can't afford healthcare on their own. So government's own model doesn't do a good job for it. And certainly the requirement at $5.15 an hour, Minnesota just raised it some, but the minimum wage nationally is not enough to live on. Again, $8 an hour is not enough to live on. So why the politics of the minimum wage? Well, every time we talk about it, I've been there for 20 years now, and we've raised the minimum wage probably three times in that time. And each time we raise it by, last time it was by a dollar an hour, but since the last raise, inflation probably robbed its value of a dollar and a half or two. And the politics of it are, if we do this, it's a major burden on business. It's going to lose jobs. It's going to make the poor worse off because they won't have any job. So the idea that we talk about a living wage is kind of, well, look at the burden it puts on business. It's outrageous that we would want to talk about doing this to business, many of whom are struggling. And I'd suggest that maybe for 94% of Americans who believe the concept you work 40 hours a week, you should be given enough to support your family. I think it comes to the point where most Americans would say, if you think about it, we don't always think about it this way, but that the current system is what's outrageous, that we allow people to be doing what we expect to be full-time work and not get paid anywhere near what they need to do to support themselves. And so it's the situation where states have started turning, local governments more than states, started turning to what they call living wage ordinances. And I think Baltimore did one 10, 15 years ago, and since then 100 some other cities have too. And they generally are, if you get a subsidy, if you are a subcontractor of government, you have a contract with government, or you get some subsidy from government, you're required to pay a living wage. And I know St. Paul and Minneapolis and Duluth, Minnesota all have them. St. Paul, I don't know what the amount is, $8, $9 an hour, which I would argue is sub-living wage. And even then, a major Minnesota retailer was coming in to redo downtown store, and we're asking for big subsidies, which they got. And the city council, which 2 years earlier or so had passed a living wage ordinance, decided, well, you know, they wouldn't be able to make it if they had to pay that kind of wages anyhow, so they exempted them from their own ordinance and gave them the subsidy. So I've got a proposal, which I've tried. I introduced it as a bill last year. I don't want to pretend it's likely to pass next year. But I'm doing it partly to change the debate, change the focus on how we look at the issue. Because, again, you know, this is, my proposal is considered outrageously radical in the political system, but it's designed to do exactly what 94% of Americans say is basic fairness. And mine would be to have a living wage law that applies to all businesses, mine, again, in Minnesota. And it wouldn't be like a minimum wage that you have no alternative but to pay it, but this would be one that would be phased in because it would be require some significant change in thinking the way our businesses work. It would require a significant shift in thinking because it's a big jump. It's not a big jump for many employers, but when more than a third of new jobs are way below living wage, it's a major jump for a lot of employers, a lot of businesses, a lot of communities. And if you're paying your burger flippers more money, hamburgers are going to cost more, which means everybody's paying a little bit more. Basically, we're saying, though, that the workers are going to get more, which will help cover those costs, and everybody else, those of us who aren't below the living wage, will be paying more for the food we get and for the products and services we buy. It's not like it's free of charge, somebody pays those wages. Is it a radical notion? Well, depends on how you view it. My proposal, as I said, it's not a firm requirement like it is for others. It's not voluntary either. What I propose, and it was somewhat, it's more than arbitrary, but I had picked for a living wage in the Twin Cities to be $14 an hour. $2 less in Greater Minnesota, just because the cost of living is somewhat lower. So $12 or $14 an hour. And then if the employer provided full health care benefits, which our state law defines, and which I have, state employees have, many but a declining number of businesses provide, that works out to be about $3 an hour in value. So the living wage, if they meet the standard of providing health care benefits, would be $3 an hour less than that. Some would argue that it's be a, quite a struggle to make ends meet on that level, but I would suggest it would certainly reduce the burden on government in terms of subsidies for housing, in terms of health care subsidies, in terms of other services and costs to government. It would reduce the burden on taxpayers by doing that. And I proposed it that such that it would be phased in so smaller employers have more time and everything else. And what would happen if you didn't pay it? I said it's an obligation, but it's not a strict requirement. Well, I proposed a surtax, an undercompensation surtax. If the living wage in Minneapolis was $14 an hour and a Target or Kmart or Walmart pays $8 an hour, there's a $6 an hour gap in there. And initially under the bill, you take one-third of that gap, ultimately two-thirds of that gap. So if it's a $6 gap, you put $2 in and it would be a surtax, would be paid by the employer per hour they're paying that gap. Would go back not to fund any state program, not to supplement or replace the funding for housing subsidies or health care and so on, but would go into, Minnesota has a version of the federal earned income tax credit, which is paid to low-income workers to help them make ends meet. It's the way you help adjust between, so a worker employer can't pay somebody who's got more expenses, a bigger family or something, they can't decide we're going to pay that worker more than this worker because they got a family. I mean, everybody's going to hire people without families then. You have to pay them the same, but the earned income tax credit is a very efficient way of boosting the income of low-income workers. I think it was first talked about by Richard Nixon, the wild-eyed radical in the 1970s, but it's a good system and it works. But this would take that revenue that comes in effect it would be shoveled out as an increase in their earned income tax credit, their state earned income tax credit, would go back to the low-income workers. So if I'm Walmart, they're a popular one these days, if I'm Walmart and I'm paying $8 an hour, I would then be paying, because I'm $6 short of that, for the first 3 years I'd be paying a $2 an hour subsidy to the state. So the net cost of me hiring an $8 an hour employee would be for the surtax and the wages would be $10 an hour. And after 6 years, I think it is, it would jump up to two-thirds, so it would be $4 an hour. So in effect, if Walmart wants to pay their employee $8 an hour, they can do so, but their net cost is $12 an hour, $4 of which is going to other low-paid workers around the state. And at a certain point, I would argue by that point for sure, most employers would say, we're probably better off paying $14 an hour and our employee gets all of it instead of paying $12 an hour and our employee only gets $8 of it, because there are, I mean, the Costco's of the world, which are in the same market as the Walmarts and so on, they have, their employees have a wage of about twice as high. And they make, how do they do it? Is it charitable effort on their part? Well, they find out that the very high cost of training and recruiting new employees goes down significantly because employees who are paid better are going to stay. And they're going to presumably work harder. And you get more loyalty, you get other things if you treat them well. So an employer like Walmart might decide, we're better off paying the $14 an hour to our person than paying them only $8 an hour since it costs us almost as much or two-thirds as much. Anyway, this is obviously seen by people as a fairly radical shift in the political world, and it would be a radical shift at the beginning in the economic world. We as a society haven't accounted for changes a lot. 40 years ago, childcare wasn't a big deal. All parents stayed home with the children. Now, if you suggested, well, we should require all parents to children have one parent stay home, well, first of all, a lot of single-parent families, there's no way you could do it other than just massive increases in welfare funding, which is what people are complaining about. But we haven't taken care of the fact that what was considered under our economy free labor parents staying home with the children, raising children. Well, what we did was, because we considered it free labor, even if it's one of the most important things we do as a society, well, when we gave it to other people through childcare, what do we pay them? Very poor wages. And even in cases where many people who have college degrees are working in childcare centers and making $8-9 an hour, at least in Minnesota, that's the case. So there'd be some major shifts in the economy over time as this would be implemented. I provided, of course, things like phase-in, permanent phase-ins for small new businesses, things of that sort. Well, is this an unsustainable burden on business? Well, it depends how you look at it. If the minimum wage had kept up with average CEO compensation since 1990, the minimum wage would be over $12 an hour. $12 an hour since 1990. And I have yet to hear a single corporation, including those struggling, take Northwest Airlines, our local airline that's on the edge of bankruptcy, has been negotiating with pilots and flight attendants and machinists and everybody else about givebacks in compensation, because they're, if you don't do this, we're going to bankruptcy court, they're going to force it on you. Not once have I heard a single thing, official statement from Northwest Airlines saying, you know, we're really hurting. This burden of high wages for our CEO and our top executives is killing us. And they don't take away the high compensation they get. And if it's not a burden, not a burden to triple CEO compensation over a number of years, it shouldn't be considered a burden on that business to be paying their workers more. Instead, we should be recognizing what they've done is it's taking the burden off the taxpayers, because, again, as I said, when if you pay your workers inadequate amounts, they don't die from it. They get the subsidy from public. And in terms of the amount of money, sometimes people say, well, you know, if you're suggesting we that high-income folks make too much money, and but even if you tax them heavily, it wouldn't make any difference. It's not really enough money out there to take care of the needs of healthcare and others. For others, Minnesota, 2004, we have this United Healthcare national firm and Minnesota-based firm, and the CEO of that, which he usually ranks the top in business executive compensation in Minnesota, for the years 2003, 2004, I don't have newer numbers, he made $94 and then $124 million in compensation those 2 years. Anyhow, whoever one of our alternative newspapers calculated, or they used some economist who's working on universal health care, they calculated if he had accepted a paltry $19 million for those 2 years, the $200 million in reduced compensation he would have received would have been enough money to insure all 77,000 Minnesota kids who are without health care. One executive in the healthcare field, I think I'd argue that $9.5 million a year is pretty good compensation. Yeah. You could still leave him that much compensation, and it would, I mean, you're not going to tax him that way, but in effect, I'm just saying that there's real money out there. Again, this proposal, it is interesting the way our political discourse works, because a concept that has 94% public support, in theory, and granted, if you say, well, how about this and this and this, you're not going to have 94%, but you know, in politics, 60% is a landslide. And while there's that kind of support for this out there at a state capitol, oh, the idea of raising the minimum wage by 50 cents an hour is a highly, hotly contested, controversial issue, and the idea that somebody should be talking about pretty heavily forcing, not requiring, but pretty heavy pressure on businesses to pay more than double that, or depending on the situation, roughly double that, is such an idea, a notion that's so radical that nobody dares talk about it. Anyway, I'm using that as an idea. I've introduced the bill. I haven't had a hearing on it yet. I do intend to press for one next year. But I just curious to reactions to it and how you see this whole issue, because, again, the wage gap in our country. We had done better than most countries earlier in our years, certainly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, early 60s. We had done a much better job of flattening out the wage disparities between the top and the bottom. We had a large, since World War II, a large middle class, the largest anywhere in the world, in terms of people who were able to afford their own home, who had what we call the American dream. It's not so obvious that we're slipping away from that because people have untold computer toys and everything else, but in many ways we're leaving more and more people behind. So with that, I'll open it up for discussions, either questions about the proposal or challenges to it, or whichever way you want to go with it. So in the back there first.
The question that I have is, I serve a little tiny congregation that a lot of the people there work in our local minimum wage job market. And what I see happening with that minimum wage job market is this, that my workers need to be at their total beck and call. So that rather than employing more employees, I would guess to save the healthcare costs, these people will many times work 60, 70 hours a week. And if they refuse, they lose their job.
Right.
So it's an issue of, you know, you're talking 40 hours a week. I mean, that's a joke. And it has all sorts of implications for the church community because these guys are so exhausted by Sunday that you know, all they want to do is sleep or do their shopping for the week because it's the only time they've got. And so I'm not an economist at all, to kind of wrap my mind around this idea of the, you know, where you give a different, you have a different minimum wage if full health care is paid. But I wonder if that would help this issue of companies doing forcing 60, 70 hour weeks, would that help? Or is that just a totally different issue, a totally different problem?
I'll try and comment on that. I'm not sure if others have comments on it. But first of all, in terms of the cost of healthcare and whether you pay somebody, again, in this proposal, it was meant to be sort of healthcare neutral in the sense that it is about a cost of about $3 an hour to provide what we call health care in Minnesota, which does not require dental coverage and does not require certain other things, but it does have, it's a pretty standard thing. All our health care plans provide that. To the worker who needs to make ends meet, it doesn't matter whether the money comes in as cash compensation or whether it comes in as health care benefit or housing benefit or whatever, which is unusual, but
right.
Whatever, the bottom line is you need so many dollars to meet all these needs.
Mm-hmm.
The point of this being whether I don't know whether you're Washington or what state you're from, but
I'm Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
This
well,
is Taylor Corp.
Okay.
Could be more specific.
Okay.
Where Taylor is this multimillionaire and
yeah,
you know.
Our minimum wage now going up to $6.15 an hour. Well, this would basically, in greater Minnesota, would say if you provide health care benefits, you'd be required to pay $9 an hour and health care benefits. In effect, it would be doubling their compensation. It would make it easier. The 60 to 70 hours a week, I would guess, very easily could be a federal labor law violation. If they're not paying them time and a half.
Well, they are paying them time and a half,
okay.
But it must be still cheaper
it's still cheap,
that than it is to employ another worker.
More people. They have all sorts of ways of doing it. If an employer does provide health care benefits, they'll often have people working at, well, the most we'll give you is 35 hours a week, which is not full time, so therefore under our policies we don't give you benefits. And Target Corporation which used to be Dayton Hudson, well, it's now changed names again, but they were known as one of the good employers who provided benefits and everything. In recent years, they've been copying the Walmart mode. You don't pay people much. You do have them work less than full time, so you don't give them the benefits your plan calls for. In any case, if you're struggling at $6.15 an hour or $8.50 an hour, whatever your wage is, if you an extra dollar an hour or two certainly makes life easier. But the forced overtime is a big issue. I mean, even for professions like nursing in Minnesota and many parts of the country, the forced overtime is becoming a real problem for some.
Seems like you're ignoring the very basic law of economics, which says that if a commodity is in huge surplus, the price goes down. If it's in short supply, the price goes up. And that applies to prices and applies to labor. And I think what you're trying to do with what you're talking about is to enforce a price control, which is labor cost control, ignoring the very basic issue. We have a surplus of labor in this country. And we're getting more and more all the time. Business pushes for this cheap labor from Mexico and other places. And in California, where we live, 20, 30 years ago, the hotel services and the restaurant services were all done mostly by black people who were unionized and got a living wage. The companies brought in all these people from south of the border, mostly Mexicans, mostly, legal or illegal. They flooded the market, and I'm sure you realize too that when you see these figures in the paper, and quote unemployment is 5%, that's a phony number. Mm-hmm. That only includes the people that are on unemployment insurance, and that runs out. They're dropped from that number, so that number of 5% is only the unemployment insurance people. It's not the number of people that are out of jobs. It's not the people that would like to get a job if they could afford childcare. Mm-hmm. But they can't even get it for childcare because they can't make enough money to pay for childcare. So they don't work. So there's a lot of workers in this country that aren't working because of all this huge mass immigration we've been proposing in the last, well, since 65 actually, when we started this new immigration law, 86 when we decided to fine employers for hiring illegal immigrants. Never enforced it to speak of.
That's right.
And so now we got this 12 million illegals in this country, plus all the other legal immigrants are driving our wages down. And if we limit this, then the law supply and demand will take over and they'll have to pay higher wages. It doesn't require new laws or anything. We've got the laws on the books right now.
Well, let me suggest that one of the reasons, and again, the idea that employers have no consequence for hiring undocumented workers, which they're not supposed to be doing. One of the reasons they do it is, as you said, because they can pay them less.
That's right. Absolutely.
If they are required to pay them more, there's no benefit for hiring the illegal person for which they can have the penalty. And bottom line is, one of the ways you address that issue, one of the ways, it's not the only way, is that if you, one, enforce wage laws and have a wage, its requirement that's sufficient that an American worker will be able to make ends meet on it. It takes away some of the employer's incentive to break the law and hire the illegal immigrant. And again, trying to enforce that against employers would be probably the biggest single way to address immigration issue. But the bottom line is, in terms of economic supply and demand, I mean, it's never been a perfect system. The fact that if you were working at, and I don't know if Boeing has had any big layoffs in recent years, I think they did several years ago, I don't know where they are in cycles right now, but you take an employer like Boeing or lots of employers in relatively businesses that are large for their community. Take meat packers in Austin, Minnesota. All of a sudden they decide we can chop meat cheaper somewhere else, and maybe the meat packers tend not to be, you pack the meat overseas for costs of shipping and so on, but a lot of products, well, we will just pack up and move to wherever. In any town, whether it's downsizing because of economy or whatever, an employer lays off 800 people who are making 18, 20 bucks an hour, the next week all they can find is $7 an hour. If law of supply and demand worked, then that $18 an hour employee is worth $18 an hour, and therefore why can't they find another job? In other words, it generally works, but there are so many exceptions to saying that supply and demand laws are going to take care of wages. It never has worked perfectly, and if we had laws that enforce certain things better, it would help. But again, the fact that one day I'm making so and so many $1,000 a year, and the next week I've been laid off, doesn't mean all, and I can't find a new job, doesn't mean that all of a sudden all my skills went away and everything else. It just means that things change there beyond control. It's never been a perfect, the economy never responds perfectly to something. But
laws that you're talking about, okay, have all kinds of ways of getting around it too, by contract labor, by temporary labor.
True, but that's what I'm saying. That's why you have a 14, if you have the fixed level, sure, they can get by paying no less than that, but you still have to pay that much.
The other problem, too, with the surplus of labor is the middle class in this country. I mean, I know a lot of technical people have been laid off, and then you hire an Indian from India to take their place, and you say, how can that be? Well, what you can do, you can define a job category so narrowly that only this person will fill the job. Mm-hmm. You know, for an H-1B visa to be given, you got to have a job which Americans won't fill. Mm-hmm. But that's fraudulent too. I mean, you just find the
people
job narrowly enough that you can bring this person in. And one case I saw recently was about a black woman supervisor of a technical in an immigration system company in the Bay Area that was told she was going to be laid off. And she had to train her replacement from India to take her job.
Right.
And if she didn't, she'd be fired with no retirement benefits.
Right.
If you do this, we'll give you benefits when you lay off.
Right. No,
what
happened. I mean,
Faustian choice.
Employers have frequently done that to people where you train your replacement and then you're gone. But over here and then here, we're moving this way. Did you have a comment? Or?
Yeah. It escaped me.
I'll come back to you.
I was going to say, the pure economic theory assumes that you have the privilege of withholding your labor if you don't like what they're going to pay you. But the fact is, you got to eat. So you don't have that option of saying, no, I won't work. I'll just take the year off.
That's why we have a regulated market economy, because there's nothing so magical about the market that it meets all the needs. And when we get into the issue of outsourcing to India for software or outsourcing to other countries for producing things cheaper, you get into the whole global issues of fair trade issues versus free trade issues, and are there going to be standards, or do we go to the lowest common denominator if we take away all labor standards, all wage standards, all environmental standards, and somebody can produce a product cheaper without doing those things, and do we want our international economy to be built that way?
So this bill you're proposing, is that a state law?
State proposal, yeah.
That to me is I would think would be suicidal politically.
Politically,
because I don't see any state being able to do what you're trying to do. It's got to be done at the national level at the very least.
Certainly be better at the national level.
But, I mean, I could well imagine businesses leaving to go, they'd go across the border, people would cross the border to buy their goods where things would be cheaper. I just don't see how you would be able to do it.
Let me suggest a couple of things. One, that that when states try things, it helps to have more states, and in certain environmental standards in terms of a number of things, often you have states going together. I put this out there not expecting it to become law next year. I'd like to try and make it, but I'd like to suggest that your concern, while some legitimate, is also way overstated. For one thing, a lot of the biggest employers and the ones who have the most foot-free, the most loosely able to move, are the ones who are paying the living wage anyway. And you get to there's a Burger King in Roseville where I live. we're 40 miles from, 30 miles or less from Wisconsin border. You know, if Burger King has to pay higher wages, you know, they could move to Hudson, Wisconsin, except there's a problem with that. One, there's already a Burger King in Hudson, Wisconsin, and two, they're very site-specific. They want to sell burgers to people where they are. And same thing with retailers. You have more of a problem, and the problem tends to occur in the border communities where you can cross the line, and I mean, states have the same thing between gas taxes and everything else. There's definitely some of that, and that's why if you were to overnight take something where you were going to say we're going to jump from $6 an hour to in a small greater Minnesota community to 11 to 12 bucks an hour, doubling the wage, you would have problems between borders. And I'm not suggesting it's perfect that way, but I do agree it would be much better at the national level. Part of the reason for floating ideas like this is one, so other states get the idea, and two, so you try and build support at the federal level, and three, so it sends the message that there is a burden paid caused by wages, and the burden is, I would argue, not so much on business as it is on taxpayers right now.
But I would just make one other point, sure. And that is I don't even think it can be done at the national level, a shift of that magnitude, because then you've got the same problem with our declining competitiveness in the global economy. And I just don't, I mean, we're already losing jobs, particularly manufacturing jobs, but, you know, even now software jobs to, you know, very well-educated, young software code developers in India and China and elsewhere. I mean, it's there's this wage arbitrage going on all around the world, companies searching for the lowest cost labor. And right now, the United States is at a wage level that is still encouraging that. So what you would be doing would be actually encouraging the acceleration of that outsourcing.
We could certainly undo some of the tax benefits. I mean, we tried in Minnesota last year to try and, our state has some of the worst laws in terms of exempting people from overseas foreign operating corporation money. How our tax policy is here, you set up a sham transaction in order to avoid state taxes. And certainly, there's some of that. I mean, in terms of software engineers, very few of them are under $14 an hour in this country. And the shift overseas, this thing wouldn't affect that. What this would have the impact on is the people who are making widgets. That it wouldn't be the higher paid occupations here, it would have the other one. Anyway. You know.
Yeah, I checked into a hotel in Bellevue, which is the Ritz of the Ritz. Actually, I checked in at the DoubleTree and I stayed in that hotel 3 or 4 nights, and I checked out of a Hilton, so it was changing hands right then and there. but when I checked in, the woman that was checking me in answered the telephone 3 times while I was checking in, and she made some mistakes. And so when I checked out, I tried to get it cleared up, and the woman that checked me out answered the telephone 3 times while I was checking out. And the conclusion that I come to is that they just simply don't have enough people on the desk because they want every worker to do 2 jobs, not 1.
Yeah, right.
And to do it in that 8-hour period, too, I'll bet you. But Washington State has, I think, the highest minimum wage in the United States. It's well over $7. And even that, we know we can't live on it.
But there's a lot of people that are exempted from it, too. Basically.
Well, yeah, the agricultural people are exempt from it.
Restaurant workers.
And who?
Restaurant workers.
Restaurant workers, yeah. They add their tips on as part of their salary. It's a lovely system.
Earlier this week, we watched a movie about Jamaica, and essentially their policies destroyed whatever industry they had in the country, so the jobs went away. We've talked a little bit about globalization. So essentially, the Walmart and Burger King, these are retail. Well, the food industry has to be pretty much on the spot. But I'm waiting for the stores to combine a store with the internet. So you walk in and there's one product there, and you sit there and you dial up and you order it to come to your home later. So you get rid of all the labor costs in the retail. So, you know, again, this type of incentive, as valuable as it might be, you know, again, it encourages the employers to cut down on the number of jobs.
The employers, I mean, one of the issues there is something we as a national economy and a world economy and a state and local economy have to figure out is how we're, there are going to be shifts. I mean, when Detroit has been learning very, very, very slowly that they're laying off people who they thought were going to be working with them forever, and some of their retiree healthcare benefits are very heavy and it's hitting them a lot. But the thing is, there will be fewer people doing the same jobs in the future, given the way we're moving, one with technology and so on. But we have to decide how we want to do it. I mean, the heavy pressure from, I would say, more than one side of the political aisle on international trade issues is always, this is good for everybody. We all benefit the gross domestic product of each country. It goes up when we have NAFTA, when we have CAFTA, when we have GATT, when we have all of the new trade agreements we have, world economy goes up. If the trouble is, it's not an even thing. If we were to open free trade agreements with virtually all the countries in the world, I mean, I saw a thing that over the next decade, the gross world product, the economy of the world would boost by several hundred billion dollars. However, the actual gross domestic product of the poorer countries was actually going down as part of that. And the shifts in each country, too, tend to be, I mean, I would argue that if NAFTA, if the economists who said NAFTA was a good thing, it was going to raise the standard of living for both Mexicans and Americans, you take the agriculture field, it was upping the salaries, the income and revenue for certain agribusinesses, but farmers here and farm workers there and so on, their standard of living is probably going down because of it. So it's the inequality that's causing a lot of the problems. A lot of the shifts in the economy, you're not going to be able to say you shouldn't be trying to be more efficient, and if you have a machine do something cheaper than a person, that happens anyway. The question when you're paying, I don't know what DoubleTree or Hilton or whatever it was charged for a night's room, but again, the expectation in our economy is that if you're not making such and such percentage profit return for shareholders, you're not doing well enough. I mean, newspapers, well, they all have to cut back. Why? Not because they're unprofitable, but because they're not making as much profit as the expectation is. And we've got to change what the expectation is if we're going to address it.
Can I address that?
Sure.
I really raised my hand first, and I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. There's two things that, if anyone has not read The World is Flat, Brief History of the 21st Century by Thomas Friedman, read it. It is absolutely eye-opening and enlightening. It's a wonderful book. And one of the things that it talks about is that a lot of the mindset of Americans has been that we're going to get a job and we're going to have, you know, healthcare benefits and all of this stuff with minimum education and training, and that we're going to keep it for 30 years and we're going to retire. Well, you know what? That's gone. It's history into the dust. Okay? That's never going to happen because we are now competing with the world. We are not competing. Microsoft has three training facilities. One of them is in Redmond, Washington. One of them is in Beijing. And the other one is in Bangalore, India. Guess which one's the biggest? It's not Washington. Yeah, it's the one in Beijing. And they have thousands of well-educated people that try for every single spot in those training facilities. I mean, we have not kept up with the world. We are losing market share, if you will.
And in the meantime, we're borrowing from other countries.
Right. And one of the things that it says in this book also is that if you are just, you know, thinking that you're just going to get your skills and move ahead and, you know, get ahead in the world, it's not going to happen because you have become what's called plain vanilla in his terminology. And plain vanilla Once you became plain vanilla, you are out of there. I mean, you have to reinvent yourself constantly, and you have to put yourself with little red sprinkles or, you know, whatever. I mean, it told the story of a guy who was a graphic artist and how, you know, he went through a whole bunch of morphs, if you will, and now he specializes in morph art. You've seen the art where, you know, it starts with Madonna and ends up with Britney Spears. Well, that's what he specializes in. You know, and he says, and I know I probably won't be able to continue that for, you know, 10 years. I'm going to have to come up with another specialty because that's pretty soon going to become plain vanilla and I'm going to have to move ahead. And the people that don't have the education and training can't do that. Second point is that you were talking earlier about the Wall Street and the Costco and the, or, I mean, excuse me, the Walmart and Costco.
What's the difference?
Yeah, and Target. Okay, the reason why Target is doing the same thing as Walmart is because their shareholders are going, wait a minute, you know, you are not making us as much money as the people that own Walmart stock. I'm going to sell Target and buy Walmart. I mean, they don't have any choice because they are getting Wall Street pressure to do this.
That's right.
So, I mean, fascinating.
That's exactly why they're doing it. Though it is, that's why it's nice to see the Costco types that are making ends meet.
That's right, but they are bucking the trend, and they are saying, hey, they have to convince their shareholders every single meeting that it is worth it, because even though we're not making quite as much, you know, we have a loyal clientele, we have loyal employees, you know, if we traded to do the Walmart version, we wouldn't have anywhere near as much profit as we do have.
Yes,
but it's a tough sell. Yeah. It's a tough sell.
I'm not arguing with you on that. Here, then over here. Okay.
I think we've got a significant problem because of the medical costs due to our aging population. First of all, I'm well aware of the fact as an older person that my medical costs are just skyrocketing because I have problems that previous years I would not have had, so I wouldn't be living now. Mm-hmm. And also, we have medical insurance, which I think encourages us to spend more money on medical costs than otherwise. So I think we've got a real problem here that this is going to be a very increasing drain on our resources. And also, I think the fact that we have insurance now encourages us to submit claims that we simply wouldn't have spent money on previously. Also, our medical system, we have tremendous improvements on what can be done, but these are all costly. Now, all of these things add up to very increased costs of medical care.
And I
think this is an increasingly tremendously drain on what we can afford to do. And where's all this money going to come from?
Okay. Well, let me comment on that quickly. The healthcare issue is certainly, when you talk about American business, take the auto industry because it's one of the classic ones, where some of the estimates of the cost that an auto manufacturer has in higher cost, manufacturing costs, because of healthcare benefits of their employees and their suppliers' employees, that the cost is like 15% higher for American automaker than when in Japan, where healthcare is not provided by the employer, it's provided by the it's a federally funded thing. The same sort of issue there. I mean, our average cost of healthcare is something like 60% higher than Switzerland, which is the second most expensive country in the world. And our healthcare system, while we may have the best technology or had the best technology, some of the best trained people, again, we're slipping there too, but ours was such a system that all of the major indicators, life expectancy, child mortality rates, and so on, we do worse than any of the other industrialized countries. And why is it? Well, we've got such a grossly inefficient system And I would argue part of your point is sometimes people get care they don't need. Our biggest problem in terms of outside of things like administrative costs of billing, where half, it's over a third now of our healthcare dollar goes into administrative costs. But the other part of it is that a lot of people don't get the care they need until it's late. They get emergency room care when they should have had the preventive care. And our system's basically set up to do that. So we have one problem with overutilization of the system. We also have, a bigger problem with underutilization, where I don't go see the doctor because it's too expensive until I'm going to the emergency room. And but our healthcare system, again, is, I don't think anybody would call it anywhere near efficient.
There are improvements we've made, but I think there is still a basic underlying problem that we are getting older, right, and medical care is becoming more complicated, more expensive, and where's all this going to come from?
It is in other countries too, but yes. Over here, we'll try.
Sorry.
We got a minute, but yeah.
And just two things. I think some of the biggest problems that come from this, that kind of the living wage question stems from, is the idea that what happens to you doesn't affect me, you know? And then I think those are those globalization issues, you know, those kind of state issues, those immigration issues. Like, what happens to other people does affect us. And the other thing is that I think it's a business ethics issue. You know, that the goal of business right now is to make a lot of money for a few people. And that's just a problem. You know, the goal of business can't be to make money. The goal of business has to be to keep people supported and living and happy in a community.
Our entire economy these days is based on the idea of returning more money to those who have it, returning,
yes,
rate of return for those who have invested money. That is our number one goal of
exactly.
The whole economy structured, and it's a good point.
I think one of the problems is that it is economically beneficial for the economic system and industry to say the sky is falling and will fall if you change anything.
Mm-hmm.
If one looks at Europe, where wages are in fact higher, where healthcare is taken care of, where you have a shorter work week, to point there and say, look, that's a failure, it doesn't make sense to me.
In how we get out of where we are now is a good question, but I do think whether it's healthcare or, again, job loss because of whether it's globalization or whatever, I think you do come to a point where it becomes, healthcare, the first time it's going to affect our family is when our daughter graduates from college next year and all of a sudden isn't covered under our plan.
That's right.
And if she wants to go overseas for a couple of years with some group, presumably they'll take care of her healthcare needs. But when she comes back here and gets a job or goes to grad school, it's becoming a crisis for middle America, and at that time, political will to address things both through fair tax code and through other policies, I think, happens. But I think we're just quarter two when we're supposed to quit.
Yeah.
If so, I'm happy to stay around and talk more, but we better call it official. Thank you very much for your time.